before they do any fundraising or expenditure, before they do any activity, they have to register with us.
Working to clarify campaign contribution rules for Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage officials ponder an influx of new military residents.
Where do you put a couple thousand people? The military, you know, has a big responsibility ahead of them if they're going to transfer that many people down from Fairbanks.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
The body of a 64-year-old Kodiak man was found just outside the mouth of St. Herman Harbor late this morning. Kodiak Police Chief T.C. Kamai said the body didn't appear to have been in the water very long.
At about 10:53 this morning, we received a 911 call reporting that a body was observed floating in the channel. It was subsequently recovered by harbor masters who responded to the area with a skiff and brought to shore, where they were met by EMTs from Kodiak Fire Department, and they pronounced the subject deceased. We've subsequently identified him as 64-year-old Donald Werby of Kodiak. We've been able to establish that he was in St. Herman Harbor on the floats earlier in the day.
Kamai says there was no obvious sign of trauma, but that Werby's body will be sent to the medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy to pin down the cause of death. The chief says the police would like to talk with anyone who may have seen Werby in the harbor this morning. Next of kin have been notified. Alaskans will see a new element in state politics this year, an unlimited amount of money. The money will come from independent expenditure groups, or IEGs. Those IEGs are organizations that work outside a candidate's regulated campaign, and because of a 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision, work outside the legal limits and restrictions the state had imposed on donors and campaigns in previous elections. The Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC, this week approved a staff report shaping how the state will work with the independent groups. The report reflects the Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission case that allowed corporations, labor unions, and political action groups to directly participate in campaigns with no federal oversight. Paul Dauphiné, APOC's executive director, says the state report finds Alaska's current campaign contribution rules may be out of compliance, saying the Supreme Court has, quote, potentially rendered those restrictions unconstitutional as applied to groups that make only independent contributions.
That's a fair characterization of what Citizens United has done potentially to Alaska campaign finance laws. And I say potentially, obviously this needs to be decided by the courts.
Following the Supreme Court decision, the legislature added requirements to state law designed to protect voters while remaining in line with the federal courts. The state focused on the public being made aware of the donors behind the independent groups. They now must be named in political advertising and promotion. However, Dauphiné says identification begins earlier than an ad campaign.
We will know when they register with APOC. Before they do any fundraising or expenditure, before they do any activity, they have to register with us.
Currently, there are four independent groups registered in the state. One of them is the bipartisan 1,000-member-strong Alaska Conservation Voters. Jane Anvik is on the board of directors. She says they can't coordinate their activities with campaigns.
We have the opportunity to both contribute directly to the campaign and also to be able to create materials that might influence voters. But we are not able to coordinate our activities with a campaign. We have to be independent from the campaign itself.
The APOC decision was in reply to questions by an independent group organizing as Alaskans Deserve Better, with the intention of promoting, quote, responsible, ethical, and transparent government. Anvik sees the advantages of having the independent status.
We are neither a tool of a campaign, nor are we in conflict potentially with how they're managing their campaign, because what we're really doing is trying to broadly educate voters about the public policy issues we're concerned about.
She says after elections, the independent groups can work freely with whoever is elected. Links to more information are at our website, alaskapublic.org. The Air Force has flagged nearly 20 buildings on Eielson Air Force Base for reuse, repurposing, or demolition as part of the plan to relocate the F-16s from Eielson to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Fairbanks leaders had another chance today to ask questions about developments in the plan during a teleconference with Air Force officials in Fairbanks. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
If the Air Force really is considering demolition, North Pole Mayor Doug Isaacson is concerned future options for Eielson Air Force Base are limited.
We were told that they are looking at military construction in terms of a useful life of a building as only 10 years. That's foolish spending. In my layman observation, we should be making buildings to last a little bit longer.
The idea that the Air Force might demolish the infrastructure that supports the aggressor squadron raised Jeff Jacobson's eyebrows as well. He's the Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor's chief of staff. Jacobson wonders if the Air Force plans to close Eielson altogether in the future.
Well, with the ongoing reports and the development of the statistics, I kind of see the handwriting on the wall as far as you keep downsizing the manpower, the buildings, the mission status. If the whole effort is to save money, it looks like the real savings is Eielson goes away eventually. And so if that's the reality, then come out and say it. Let's have an exit plan. Let's have as a community, adjust to that new reality.
Air Force Brigadier General Mark McLeod responded by telling Jacobson and the rest of the group that the Air Force's plan hasn't yet been finalized.
Ultimately, the answer to your question is we will preserve the missions that remain on Eielson, the contingency support capabilities of the location, and then we need to make a determination on what happens to the additional facilities.
Other questions were raised about how the Anchorage School District might absorb more than 1,000 students as part of the move. Questions about the effects on the housing market in both Fairbanks and Anchorage are also still in play. Those who took part in the teleconference still have questions about the Air Force's estimated 5-year, $227 million savings in manpower as well. The Tiger Team, as the group calls itself, will host another teleconference with the Air Force in 2 weeks. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
As Fairbanks officials grapple with what the F-16 move will eventually mean for their community, the Air Force is continuing with plans for the relocation to Jaber, despite opposition from Alaska's congressional delegation. Nothing is set in stone yet, but the move could bring an estimated 2,000 new residents to Alaska's largest city over the next few years. Anchorage officials are considering how the city will absorb the influx. The main concern is housing. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
It's typical military family housing with 2 to 4 bedrooms. There are rows and rows of the houses in the neighborhoods clustered around training grounds and a giant runway at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson on the east side of Anchorage.
You have the family room here, and we've decided to make it into our exercise room. Here you have the kitchen. It's kind of an open bar arrangement here. And then going into the next room, we'll see where the living room is, and we've kind of made it into it's a longer room, so we made it to a living room office.
That's Major Joseph Koss-Koslett, the Public Affairs Director for Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, touring me around his on-base 4-bedroom house. Military families are used to moving, Koslett says. They often like on-base housing, but when they can't find it, they usually look off-base for one thing.
Typical 3-bedroom house where you'll have a master bedroom and 2 smaller bedrooms.
Koslett says if the F-16 transfer goes through, that's what a whole lot of military families will be looking for in Anchorage. The military estimates the move will save roughly $227 million. The Air Force says at least 700 military and civilian personnel, plus their families, would move to Anchorage with the squadron by 2015. There is on-base housing at Jaber, but the vacancy rate is only 3%. The vacancy rate is also low off-base, and that's something city leaders are thinking about.
Where do you put a couple thousand people?
including Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan.
The military, you know, has a big responsibility ahead of them. If they're going to transfer that many people down from Fairbanks with the F-16 group, that, you know, they're going to have to work really hard with the local community to make sure there is housing.
As far as buying goes, there's just not that much available. Mary Cox is a broker with RE/MAX. She's an expert on single-family properties in Anchorage and Eagle River.
If I look at the inventory available at the end of May last year, there were 1,015 properties available last year. And this year, there's 793 as of today. And so there's less inventory. And yet the number of sales are about the same as they were last year. So the buyers do have less to choose from.
And Cox says there are just about 60 houses on the market right now in the more affordable range, between $225,000 and $250,000. That means the F-16 transfer could spur a small building boom in Anchorage. City planners say most of the vacant, biddable land in the Anchorage Bowl is scattered, and the city is running out of room for single-family homes. Karen Iverson is a senior planner with the municipality. She says, according to a recent housing study, the one place there is room to grow is in the Chugiak Eagle River area. Andre Spinelli is the owner of a home building company in Anchorage. Spinelli says in the big scheme of things, the F-16 transfer isn't a lot of people, maybe 20 to 30% of our projected population growth for the year. But Spinelli says his company has been preparing for the projected population increases. They're poised to supply housing for military personnel should the F-16 transfer go through.
I'm currently building in about 3 locations in Eagle River, and the single family houses, we're building in a subdivision called Powder Ridge that Aklutna developed, and those single family homes start, they're in and around 350 to 450,000 range.
And Spinelli says his company is about to break ground on a development of townhouses in downtown Eagle River and another of duplex-style townhomes in East Anchorage, all in the $250,000 price range. However, until the transfer is official and people start laying down down payments, he and other builders are waiting. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rain and washouts strand people along the Elkan Highway.
They're taking it all in stride. Nobody has any emergency time commitments, so they're hunkered down and watching movies.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
An Alaska-based soldier from Japan has died from wounds he received in Afghanistan. The Department of Defense yesterday said Private First Class Vincent J. Ellis died Monday in Germany. He was wounded last Friday when his unit was attacked by insurgents using improvised explosive devices and small arms fire at Forward Operating Base Salerno, Afghanistan. The 22-year-old from Tokyo was stationed at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson in Anchorage and assigned to the 1st Squadron, 40th Cavalry Regiment, 4th Airborne Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division. Mudslides and washouts caused by heavy rains and snowmelt have stranded passengers along the Alaska Highway today, and the road could remain closed into the weekend. The Alaska Highway is the main route between Alaska, Canada, and the Lower 48, and between Interior Alaska and the Alaska Marine Highway terminals in Haines and Skagway. In western Yukon, the Alaska Highway is closed between Haines Junction and Destruction Bay because of a mudslide at the south end of Kluane Lake. Yukon Highway officials are advising travelers to stay in communities until the roads are reopened. That means hotels in places like Haines Junction and Whitehorse are scrambling to find room for motorists. Marianne Bruff owns the Cottonwood RV Park in Destruction Bay and said several travelers are stuck there an extra day.
They're taking it all in stride. Nobody has any emergency time commitments, so they're hunkered down and watching movies and just enjoying the time.
She said there was heavy rain overnight, but the weather was clearing today. In Haines Junction, Clint McQuain with the Elkhan Moto Inn said a few travelers were headed to Whitehorse to hook up with the only other road into Alaska.
A lot of the people that headed out this morning got turned around, so some are staying and some are thinking of going around top of the world.
The longer and less traveled top of the world route connects Dawson City, Yukon to Tok, Alaska. King salmon numbers running through the Yukon River have been declining in recent years. Officials at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are anticipating subsistence fishing restrictions this year, a trend that has been steadily present for a few years now. From KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has more.
Steve Hayes, the Yukon Area Summer Season Manager at Fish and Game, reiterates what subsistence fishers have been hearing for months.
At this point, our projection is expected that the total Yukon River Chinook salmon run size should be between 109,000 to 146,000 in total run size.
That's even less than last year, Hayes says.
In 2011, our outlook was for a run size of 130,000 to 170,000 Chinook salmon.
For those of you scoring at home, that's a potential difference of 20,000 to over 60,000 less king salmon in the river.
So that right there tells us that we're going to have a run size either similar to 2011 or potentially it could be even worse. More severe conservation measures may be necessary.
In 2009, Hayes says, Fish and Game started to further restrict subsistence fishing during the first pulse of Chinook by canceling certain fishing windows, the 36-hour periods in which fishers are allowed to take kings.
For example, in District 1, they have two 36-hour periods a week. When you pull a 36-hour period, it actually equates to about a five-day closure because you have time that you're closed around a 36-hour period and time that you're closed at the end of that period. So it equates to about a five-day closure that you're protecting that pulse. And typically the pulses are lasting about 4 to 5 days.
Hayes says since his department started period restrictions in 2009, the numbers of Chinook coming up the river have gotten less and less, bringing on even more restrictions. In 2011, he says, there were period closures during the first, second, and even third pulses in some areas.
With these recent trends, We're having to protect these pulses to meet the escapement goals.
Hayes says that on top of the low projected numbers, the Chinook run is a little bit behind schedule this year. Test fisheries in Amonok haven't yet seen a single king. He is confident that when they do get here, though, there will be subsistence fishing restrictions similar or even more drastic than what was seen last year.
Which is, you know, not necessarily what we want to do, but unfortunately, we do need to meet the escapement goals for the future generations.
In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Officials with the U.S. Energy Department and Alaska's Denali Commission say five Alaska tribes will receive technical help for clean energy efforts. The tribes are the Venati Village Council, the Native Village of Quinnahock, the Native Village of Teller, and the Organized Village of Cake. Officials say the goal is to create local jobs and improve energy self-sufficiency.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Do you own a business or manage employees? Do you reassure employees with children that you're committed to supporting them? Well, research shows that employees who feel supported at work when handling their parenting challenges are more loyal and more productive. When you let employees know they can attend a parent-teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality child care, you contribute to stronger families. This message sponsored by Best Beginnings, Alaska's Children's Trust, and Strengthening Families Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wendy Johnson. This week on AK, hunting for ferns.
Researchers from the Smithsonian Institution visited Sitka recently. The group works at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. The collection includes countless items from Alaska. Staff members at the museum are well acquainted with those items, but they don't often get to see where the items began. To do that, they turn to Sitka resident and renowned Tlingit weaver Terry Rothkar. KCAW's Ed Ronco went along with Rothkar and the Smithsonian staff as they searched for ferns.
We're just walking up the road, guys. We're going to be looking on the uphill side, and we're looking for a fern that's reaching out from the cliffs, between the rocks.
Terry Rothkar is leading a group of seven people up Blue Lake Road. Their mission? Find the maidenhair fern.
It's a fern that for years, gosh, me and my kind of self-teaching, I got the wrong fern forever. I kept getting the wrong ferns. If you start looking around, there's a lot of different ferns here.
You do have a lot of different ferns.
There's all kinds.
Eventually, Rothkar says she had to ask a friend for help.
And I said, well, you know, Mary, having difficulty getting those ferns. Ah, geez, I've got a bunch in my yard. Just come on over. And I said, well, where do you get them in the wild? Well, honey, have you been up to the dam at Blue Lake? Right at the base of the dam, there's lots of them. I'm like...
This group does not need to hike all the way to Blue Lake in order to find some ferns. They soon appear, popping out of the rock face next to the road.
See those black stems?
Oh,
right,
yeah.
Boys and girls, and you see them when you're in looking at the baskets. It's that brilliant brown, shiny color. That's some maidenhair fern there.
The stems of maidenhair fern are used in traditional basket weaving. These researchers from Washington, D.C. have likely seen thousands of the stems before, but in finished baskets that make up part of the museum's collection, not as individual components in the wild.
We can only do so much to understand the nature of these pieces.
Kelly McHugh is an objects conservator at the National Museum of the American Indian.
Coming here gives us the context that we're missing, really, and it's a context for understanding so that we can kind of better and more responsibly care for the collection.
The group arrived in Sitka on Friday night. By Saturday afternoon, when we walked up Blue Lake Road together, they had already moved into lodging on the Sheldon Jackson campus, met with Native elders who had attended school there, visited Fortress of the Bear, and gone searching for ferns. Still ahead on the agenda was a kayaking trip, a meeting with carver Tommy Joseph at Sitka National Historical Park, and more.
We're overwhelmed. I mean, we've been here for just a day, really. And I think being welcomed at the airport with the dance group and having the elders there and just knowing what that means is incredibly impactful for us.
I am a raven from the snail house.
That's Terry Rothkar introducing herself by her Tlingit name. She says she wants to build bridges between those who preserve older native art and objects and those who are practicing the art.
Because I think what's happened is our old objects in the museums, while they represent a historical place, we're still creating those pieces. And I think now it's time to start documenting and creating a repository of what's happening today.
This group is in Sitka with help from several granting agencies, including the National Endowment for the Arts and the Cargill Foundation. Rothkar says having them on the ground, where they can see and touch and smell things, makes a big difference. She calls it place-based learning.
It's really hard for me to just keep my mouth shut and allow the place to have a first-person experience with them, because I want to say, oh, wait a minute, did you see this? So, yeah, that part's probably the hardest for me, to just be shut up and allow the place to do its job.
If Kelly McHugh from the Smithsonian is any indication, the place did its job. She says this trip will give them a new perspective when they head back to Washington. Or maybe that's if they head back to Washington.
I feel like we treat the collection with respect, but I think it's going to be approaching it in a way that we'll have a greater understanding of who made these pieces, why they made them, you know.
And you guys look like you're having a lot of fun besides.
Oh my God, it's been a blast. I think the challenge is going to be getting us to leave, really.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're visiting Pilot Station, a Yupik Eskimo village on the Yukon River that's home to about 600 people.
My name's Abraham Kelly.
been a postmaster in the community for Long Quail, so, and I also am the mayor of the city of Pilot Station, and I run a couple other things in town. People that go out and they get a lot of these animals, the fish in the summer, the moose in the winter, the birds, all kinds of nature food we share. I mean, they're like one smokehouse. It's just like a house. We'll have, in my mother-in-law's smokehouse, there's three families that run that smokehouse that cut fish. Jobs are really scarce, and there's too many people with not enough jobs, and education is important. Some of the homes are overcrowded. Like there's three or four families in one house sometimes. And that's the challenge we live, that we have to, you know, help each other's out. We had a 10-year plan, and one of the 10-year plans was that we start growing gardening, you know, and bring in some chicken and let the community raise them. Since the language has almost demolished the Eskimo dance group, I teach a lot of the young men how to sing, even if they don't understand what the song is about, but they sing the songs, and we carry the tradition of the Eskimo dancing.
Abraham Kelly is a postmaster in Pilot Station. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help this week from Ed Ronco, Ann Hillman, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wendy Jonathan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. Wendy Jonathan was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, co-worker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.